a very good band and one of the most commercially popular bands and all that. But the arrangements themselves and the performances are not on the outstanding level. I think they're just on the very, very high level. And it's Gene who makes it special, and his occasional star soloists and or singers.
Hi, that was Lemon Drop, and I'm Stuart Copeland with the fifth and last episode of Gene Krupa, Drumming Man. Whether or not you agree with the verdict we just heard from Lauren Schoenberg of the National Jazz Museum in Harlem, by the early 1950s, it was all in the past, because Krupa's big band was no more. Happily, Gene himself still had a showcase. Norman Granz had been putting on his Jazz at the Philharmonic concert since wartime, and though their competitive jam session format encouraged some raucous music, it was pretty close to what people expected of Krupa.
Actually, Gene had been a guest at one of the early Jazz at the Philharmonic concerts.
Professor Dan Morgenstern of the Institute for Jazz Studies.
And actually one of the early recordings, I think it's How High the Moon, and there's a moment there where Gene fell off the drum stool. So there's a moment of silence in that recording. Then he comes back very quickly.
It was here, with Jazz at the Phil, that Gene came into direct conflict, if that's what it was, with the human percussion machine Buddy Rich.
It reminds you a bit of Crosby's comment about Sinatra. You know, once in a lifetime a singer like Sinatra comes along, why does it have to be in my lifetime?
Drummer Richard Pite, who's going to play the part of Krupa in a centennial concert at Cadogan Hall on February 26th. The great American drummer Ed Shaughnessy knew both Gene and Buddy.
He was so generous in his praise of Buddy. He used to call him drummer supreme, the very best of all of us. I mean, those were the kind of lines that he used to give. And, you know, he knew how Buddy had really outdistanced everyone in his technical achievements and everything else. And he was the first one to say so. That, again, was part of that generous nature of his, you know?
But, as Ed Shaughnessy also says, Gene had something that Buddy never quite generated, an amazing visual appeal.
I have to tell you something Buddy Rich said one time. I can hit 8 cymbals in the time it takes Gene Krupa to hit 1, but he gets more applause for 1. Meaning he did it with such panache and showmanship, you know? I love that. I just love that.
Well, the drum battle between Buddy and Gene does manage in some ways to hold his own with his, you know, his tom-tom stuff and the sound that he gets. But Buddy, I mean, nobody should be in a contest with Buddy Rich, because Buddy Rich was a phenomenon. He had certain physical abilities to play that instrument that nobody else had. When, my God, he started out playing drums professionally at the age of 3, so he, you know, he had a head start on everybody. But Buddy was a force of nature, and there wasn't anybody who could compete with him. But I think Buddy also, to some extent, took it easy on Gene. He didn't want to show him up. They liked each other.
Dan Morgenstern. The jazz broadcaster Jeffrey Smith points to a classic handover moment from one drummer to the other.
I mean, you can hear that verve recording of, you know, Buddy and Gene, the drum battle, you know. Gene sounds great, and then Buddy comes in with him, and my God, it's like Concord taking off. And he wants it to sound like that. I'm going to cut your butt. Shunk! He's in. And it's impressive, but it's not the only way to play, is it? And I remember Norman Grant saying, you know, nobody really wants to play with Buddy Rich. I mean, he's just such a pain. Everybody wants to play with Gene.
As always, Gene was the compatibility king. But there was no way back to the big band world where this kind of leadership had thrived. Those orchestras were all but gone. And for the swing era guys, it became a question of how to keep working. Krupa biographer Bruce Klauber had strong feelings about the way Gene went.
It's very important to remember that from 1951 until his death in 73, that Gene Krupa was a small group drummer and the leader of a succession of absolutely wonderful, wonderful trios and quartets.
The material, though, reminded listeners of greater days. Some of them 20 years before, as in the case of this trio version of Benny Goodman's anthem, Don't Be That Way, with Eddie Hsu.
With his own great big bands and with Benny and with Dorsey was marvelous and groundbreaking, I would urge listeners and fans to focus as much attention on the 1952 to 73 years as they did on the work with the 30s and 40s.
It's a nice thought, but A, not much of that material is available to be heard, and B, working with trios and quartets rarely gave Gene the chance to open his shoulders as crowds always wanted him to do. It was a relief when he revisited his old band book with a reconstituted big band, taking advantage of the relative hi-fi of the LP era. Proving his devotion to percussion in a different way, Krupa even opened a drum school in partnership with his old friend Cozy Cole, typically for Gene, a cooperation between black and white Americans. Gene was a great educator, and one of his later pupils, a complete Krupa fanatic, was and is Peter Criss of the rock band Kiss.
I started hanging out like a groupie and making this man crazy. I would hang out at sound checks and this and that. And eventually he started, showing me things and playing things for me and showing me how they're done and taking some time out. And it was, I couldn't believe I was actually with my idol, my God, the man why I play drums and live today. I couldn't sleep at night knowing the next night I was going to go and see him again. It was the best thing probably in my life, one of the greatest moments of my life. And telling my mother and dad was just like dreams come true, and they were so excited for me. And one night he said to me, you got it, kid. You know, you really got what it takes. You got that. We need to make it in this business. And I was in awe.
In 1959, Gene's reputation received what should have been a giant boost, a Hollywood biopic titled, naturally, The Gene Krupa Story. What can we say about that? Well, it brought some people to Krupa, as we've heard. But history tends to agree with Gary Giddens.
The Benny Goodman story is utterly idiotic, and it has the dumbest performance by Steve Allen imaginable. But there's music in it, and I can actually sometimes sit through it. Gene Krupa's story, I just can't sit through it. The moment that I just have to leave the room is when James Darren sings Let There Be Love at a picnic that's supposed to be happening in the 1920s, and he's doing a Sinatra impression. And, I mean, the song wasn't even written until 15 years later. And from there, it's just downhill. And all this stuff about him, they want him to be a priest. And Sal Mineo has no sense of humor. He doesn't have any of Gene's charm. He doesn't have any of Gene's cool. He's just so ardent and solemn. And then the whole thing is about, you know, will he be able to get through a set because he's been a drug fiend, and is he off the stuff?
There's a party scene that's supposed to take place in 1935 where you have Bix Beiderbecke, who died, 4 years before, he's there, and not as an apparition.
You have to really pay attention for this, but somebody that comes in the door and somebody shouts, "Hi, Bix!" So that's the level that movie operates on.
Bix Beiderbecke had died in 1931. To Gene, the biggest disappointment must have been that drugs episode, that tiny accidental footnote in his life, had again been placed at the center of all his motivations.
There was a catalog, a video company selling Hollywood movies, and they, in their catalog, listed the Gene Krupa story, and in the copy for the movie, they spoke about Gene's drug addiction. And I wrote the company. I got the president on the phone, and I said, this is totally fictitious. It's ridiculous that this continues to go on.
And yet, at the time, Gene's fame was revived, so that even the teenage Gary Giddens became aware of him.
Dick Clark had a rock and roll show. It was at the Little Theater, now it's called the Ed Sullivan Theater, and we found a way that you could sneak up through the stairwell and sit in the balcony during the rehearsals. Well, right across the street from the Little Theater was the Metropole. And one time, Gene's name was out front, and we were allowed to stand in the vestibule and watch him. And it was a very exciting thing to see him, and we all just, we sort of admired him, in part because he was a celebrity, and there was just something very cool about him. So there was that. But in terms of the musicality and where his career had no direction in the last 10 years, it was just touring with the trio.
Gene's frequent trio partner, Eddie Hsu, was a multi-instrumentalist, so we even find Gene backing the plaintive sound of the harmonica.
Thank you.
of the most saddest things I ever saw on a stage was in the 60s when I was in high school. There was a jazz festival on Randall's Island. A lot of great figures. Monk was there and Ray Charles. And Gene had a small group. I can't remember if it was the trio or the quartet. But at one point, the guys walk off the bandstands so he can do the obligatory big drum solo, which he had to do because that's what people bought their tickets for. But before he played the solo, he had to, and by this time his back was killing him and he wasn't in great health, he only lived for a few more years, but he had to get up from his seat, he didn't even have a roadie to do this, walk to the front of the drums, bend over and press a button that threw a sort of lavender spot on the drums from below the bass drum to make it more dramatic. And the audience went crazy when he did it, and he played the, characteristic Gene Krupa solo, and everybody liked it. But just the sight of him having to bend over and do that instead of somebody else just coming out and hitting the switch, that was very moving and, to me, a sad thing to see for somebody who had been such an enormous star and also who continued to give so much to audiences.
And sadder things were happening in the background. Marital troubles with his young second wife, health problems, including a heart attack, and then a disastrous fire at home, which wiped out his personal archive.
There was a notice in Downbeat magazine about the fire, and that if anybody had any memorabilia on Gene, to contact him to see what possibly could be replaced. And it was a difficult time, because evidently at that time he was also diagnosed with what I think was called a benign form of leukemia, which required blood transfusions. It was a messy time. He had gone out to play a concert, I think it was at the Singer Bowl or somewhere in the outskirts of New York, and he went out with the pianist Marty Napoleon, brother of Teddy. Marty had told me this. Gene said to Marty, he said, "Man," he says, "what else can happen to me? What else can happen to me?" His wife left him, and he had the leukemia, and the house burned down. But he went out that night and played his behind off.
A sense of its own history had overtaken the jazz movement by this time, so there was pressure for the old Benny Goodman Quartet to reassemble in its original form, which was still possible. At their last meeting, Gene looked haggard, but sounded as close to his old form as Goodman was.
I saw him at a reunion with the original Benny Goodman Quartet in 72 at the Waldorf.
Lauren Schoenberg.
And then I was hanging around up at Saratoga, I believe for the last time that they played together, and I think this was summer of 73, and I actually helped carry some of his drums out on the stage for that particular engagement. And I just knew him a little bit. He'd given me his phone number because I was starting to hang around with Teddy Wilson and Goodman. And I guess I was about 15. And he gave me his phone number. And I called a few weeks later. And by the time I called, someone answered the phone at his house and said he was in the hospital. And I said, I was sorry. And they gave me his phone number in the hospital and said that I could actually call him there if I wanted to. Now, I did not really know him beyond a few meetings. But, I had the nerve of a 15-year-old or whatever. So from my high school payphone one day during lunch period, I went in and I called this hospital number on the payphone and actually spoke to him. And he sounded weak and tired, but okay. And I reminded him who I was, and he was very upbeat and very chipper and very warm. And he passed away just a few days later.
He was widely mourned and among drummers universally.
Max Roach, you would think Max Roach was very much an Afro-American warrior in terms of the respect he wanted for black music. And you would have thought that he would really be bothered by the Krupa image. Simply wasn't true. They asked him what he thought of Gene Krupa, and he just said, "a gentle and wonderful human being." And he wasn't just a student of black music like most of the folks. He was a contributor.
Peter Criss of the rock band Kiss.
Oh, man, the last time I saw the man was probably 1970. he was around New York somewhere. I think I bumped into him in Manny's music store or something on the street. And then he passed on. It was really, I was very devastated by that. I still have the news clipping. I was furiated because it was only a small piece about him. It was a little piece. I'm like, what is, the whole paper should be dedicated to him. I was so angry and hurt that one of the greatest men in the world who brought the drums forward and made them a real important instrument where people got respect, and the drummer wasn't just in the back anymore, had a little piece in the paper. I was very distraught by that. I think he would have been amazed of what he really changed in the world of drums. I mean, you know, he didn't live long enough, I think, to see that, personally. I even said to the band when we played The Garden in 77, I said, you know, if the man was living, I would have sent a limo and put him in the first, you know, sat him next to me, for Christ's sakes, up there. But I never had that honor.
Gene's centenary was January 15th, 2009. But his sound is all around us, even in the techno world. Maybe you remember Apollo 440 and their hit record Krupa, which sampled a quote from the De Niro movie Taxi Driver.
Now back to Gene Krupa's syncopated style.
Back, Gene Krupa, even with his misfortunes, was one of the best frontmen the drumming trade ever had. In the early days, the best. Those of us who never saw him really missed something.
According to a story told to me by Louis Belson,
Krupa biographer Bruce Klauber,
he said, if you get three or four drummers together, Buddy's going to do his incredible thing with a single-stroke roll, Louis's going to do his thing with the two bass drums, and Gene's going to do this little thing on the splash cymbal, and all eyes of the audience are going to go to Gene Krupa because of what he had within him, his ability to project, his ability as a showman. I remember one time in Philadelphia, toward the end of his life, Gene had come into town with a small group, and a few days prior to that, Buddy Rich had been there. And some people were speaking to me, and they said, you know what? I said, I heard Buddy a couple of days ago. I'm hearing Gene tonight. He said, I like Gene. I can't understand what Buddy's doing. I can understand what Gene is doing. So there you have it.
Gene Krupa and Roy Eldridge are closing the show with After You've Gone. I'm Stuart Copeland, and this has been Gene Krupa Drumming Man. A Ping production series for Radio 2, written by Russell Davies and produced by Graham Pass.